星空を眺めている一人きりの夜明けもたった一つの心悲しみに暮れないで君のため息なぬて春風に変えてやる日の当たる坂道を自転車で駆け上る君となるした思い出乗せてゆくよララララララ口ずさむ唇を染めてゆく君の見つけた幸せ花のように
All right, so we got J&B, Jack Manning Bancroft Bundjalung, and PK Paul Carney, and me, TY. Gonna smash this thing out now. It's a big proposition that we thought was quite long term, but of course, J&B. Gets the urgency. I can't wait for 5 years, 10 years for this one. And so we're jumping right into it. This major project out of the Indigenous Knowledge Systems Lab at Deakin University, Indigenous Systems Knowledge Collective that we're kicking off to connect up labs all around the planet, partnership with AIM, Ethic Investing out of New York, and many others. who, you know, will come into the story as we go along. So you guys want to say hello and then we'll map out the terrain.
Hello, Jingalad everyone.
There, J&B, PK.
Hi everyone. Nice to be in the combo.
Yeah. So you're from the Carney group.
All the Carney groups from me or something.
Yeah. Finance.
I should say a little bit about that. Yeah. So I'm here in Melbourne, Wurundjeri country, not far from you, Tice, obviously, and been kicking ideas around now for a few years. This particular project started coming to my vision. Firstly, when I read your book, Sand Talk, then obviously that trip in New York 20 months ago, getting a handle on the Nature Fund, and then various other weaves along the way, it's coming into clear focus. So it's really interesting to have something to be chewing on, so the real project rather than just a philosophical concept.
That's it. And you're also on the board of AIM.
Yeah, so Jack invited me to join AIM, and I chair that. And it's wonderful organisation, and of course, so it's like this web of connections that are all working on this and many other things. And I feel really privileged to be in amongst it.
Most successful, NGO in Australia, pretty much over the last few decades, and really huge, and now going global because the problems are broader in the world than us mob, because they all come home here. We don't just have a colony problem, we have an empire problem in this world. Going globally, just amazing things being set up across a whole heap of different existential threats. And I guess it's those catastrophic risk scenarios globally that we focus on, Indigenous Systems Knowledge Lab, and in all our broader networks, even out, to a whole heap of different institutes and platforms and all this stuff all the way around the planet. It's really kicking off now. We do a lot of small scale projects and all kinds of, catastrophic risk, from disinformation to climate change. This is a really big one. We have the problem of offsets and the marketplace of offsets and, carbon futures being traded, speculated on into infinity. And the land's still dying. People get to offset destruction in one place as long as they save, similar stuff in a carbon sink or a biodiversity sink somewhere else. Half these assets have turned out to be fairly toxic. It's variable, the verification and valuation systems they have in place for these. So this is something we've been working on for a couple of years, using indigenous knowledge systems, indigenous methods of inquiry, and indigenous design methods as well, to try and come up with an alternative, a way that actually protects interconnected systems that span, across entire continents and then connect up across the globe, because we know that ecosystems move, and that a lot of the species are migratory, and you can't just measure what's there for your quarterly reports, because our seasons everywhere in the world don't work that way. They don't line up with your financial year. So yeah, coming up with lots of things. Part of the big one for the future and for the next decade is looking at the increase in climate refugees. We have, I don't know, we've had four cyclones back up home, just boom, 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 this season. And that doesn't happen. The world is changing. Towns, cities have to be evacuated. Most of the people in Australia are living around the coastline. That's increasingly precarious. Jack, your sister, they're working with the Koori Mail on the big project in Lismore, where the Aboriginal community from far and wide came there, mobilized, for far longer than the news cycle. Our Indigenous news cycle goes for years, not 2 weeks. So everyone forgot about the floods in Lismore, but that's still being cleaned up. There are still people unhoused, many, many people unhoused. And all over Victoria, from bushfires, not just the last one, but the one before, people are still unhoused. So we have a lot of problems here we can deal with in one situation, one project. We have itinerant populations increasing all the time, unhoused people, climate refugees, political refugees, migration, immigration, all over the place. And all these people have really good strategies, systems, for surviving on the move, and for staying in temporary shelters. We also have the biodiversity problem. We have a lot of people who want to around the world who want to put money into real solutions, and we have the problem of the destructive nature of the offsets industry and trading that's going on around the world, which often ends up killing more than it saves, destroying things in one place and preserving another for a little bit of time anyway, until the next mining company comes in. So here we are. We propose how we do this is by, and where we're different is that we're talking about re-embedding human beings into their ecological niche, re-embedding them in the landscape, because as we know in Aboriginal Australia, the land is sick. If people aren't in it, people need to be in this place. You can't just fence off, wall off, slap a border around, an area of forest that you're going to keep. That becomes a little island of death. And then, people need to be in there. People need to be living there, not commuting to do a bit of ranger work throughout the week. So we want to establish these prototype, kind of seasonal itinerant villages. And with, of course, a core of people who are permanent residents there, sort of spread out, well-designed communities. So we have to think about governance, psychology, internal economies, and then how they interact with the external economy, through being able to sell these unique packages, these investments in these projects, where you've got all the people living there committed to working hard, resolving the biodiversity issues there, building it up, but then connecting with other communities in embassy and trade, and a pretty dynamic system of peer review where people are going around and making embassy with the other villages, staying there for a while and giving feedback, making sure that the inevitable cult dynamics that come with intentional communities don't end up taking over. So you've got one permaculture guru who has 12 wives, and which tends to happen a fair bit. So yeah, we've been working hard to design that system and to also think of new mechanisms and new ways of doing multiple data set consultation and Indigenous consultation in a system of verification, evaluation of these assets. So that's about where we're at. And yeah, we're looking at a piece of land in Victoria, Toowoomba on Tonorong land at the moment for a prototype community, and we have a few other projects on the boil. But that the potential of that particular one, and then the broader focus as well of what sort of funding we need to have and support to build this thing, and the general urgency of it. That's what we're going to yarn about today. So where do we kick off? Jack, do you want to look big picture first? And all of the connects with all the relationships and all the pieces that come together. And then Paul, we might zoom in and go micro, micro, micro into this this beautiful place that we're looking at.
Yeah, I think we've got a like that. Sorry, that you got an echo from me, or you're good?
Yeah, it's all right.
So that's
Not
I
as
think
fast as me, but.
one of the really significant opportunities here is finding the middle ground engineering. So this isn't a woo-woo project. And so when we look at the elements, you've got land. And I think where we haven't invested at scale is a repeatability around Indigenous knowledge systems, holders and operators, labs that can be existing in that land. So that's your MIT Media Labs model, then dispersed and decentralized around the world. So you have thousands of these labs. And instead of us going to engage with Indigenous people and saying, can you entertain me and give us a little bit of your cultural artifacts so I can feel good about some mystic world, which I never understand. We actually engage in process and design, and we solve problems together. We do that in embassy, which I think is that other third element, creating these spaces for embassy and exchange in a really disrupted colonial empire model that we've inherited, where the bridges were not built, and there, so many people were excluded, and nature was primarily excluded. I think then you start to get into in the challenge and the design is working out where the in terms of the dollar moving. Let's say someone internationally turns up with $20 million and wants to invest in some lots of land in Australia for carbon offsets. And so let's say there's three lots of land, which we've got two that we've just helped support through AIM in New South Wales with the two Indigenous knowledge holders to scoop. And one of them, this old uncle, is place burnt down the bushfires, and he personally has then replanted 4,000 native plants. Now he's got all of this knowledge alongside that, and that custodial knowledge, not just in the plants, but how the whole ecosystem works and the region works. And so, how does part of that dollar value that knowledge and the person in the landscape? And so, there's sort of the person who's got that Indigenous knowledge as a deep knowledge holder. And then there's, I think, rewarding and incentivizing that custodianship behavior. And that's where I think we start to get to scale, because otherwise you're looking at, 20, 1,000, 5,000, like really beautiful, mecca-y, like perfect bioregional groups while the world still burns, and you have your big cities which eat themselves. And so that we have to work out what happens in cities, because if we can't work out what happens in cities, then it's just going to be a plaything intellectually for us. And that's where I think a group like an Airbnb becomes a really fascinating potential partner. And it's where office buildings with empty office space where people have run away become this really fascinating ecosystem to think about. We have space that's there, and we have, like with Airbnb, you have a decentralized community that can incentivize and reward behavior from property owners. And there's a few different like global players that could really work on how you accelerated this bioregional health for every ecosystem, every postcode in the world. And then I think there's groups like the Guardians of the Earth that we've been talking to for the last few years which are very interesting groups at mapping real time the regions and being able to give us these digital twins where we can actually track the impact of that as well. So I think that's there as one one piece. Like we actually have to get the rich starter realm set for every postcode in the world. It can't just be 10. So in parallel, challenging the, you know, this group 10,000 cities that are trying to work on 10,000 healthy cities we've been yarning with, and they've all got to go at once. Like we can't be waiting a decade for this. Like we've got to be getting a sense of that movement in parallel. And then I think in terms of your transient home piece, we have to get governments to commit to unfixing houses and to be able to have houses being able to be mobile and move. And if we can have more mobility with how our houses can move, you can have tiny homes that can move, which we had a yarn on before, and we can have the ability to move with the climate. So when that cyclone or that flood comes into a town, that we can get the trucks in and we can move 5,000 homes up the hill. We have a chance to move with the inevitable, which is here. And so I think if we fix ourselves, we're stuffed. So that requires a very different set of behaviors around investment and housing and thinking about what the form of the property looks like and having, you know, 2 to 3 spaces for each town to move to. So you're thinking about festivals locations, you're thinking about these big lots of unused land and going, okay, that shouldn't just be emergency. Maybe that's where we go in summer and yeah, trying to build this transient nature. So I think
it becomes like a pre-evacuation situation instead of evacuation. Yeah. And it's a place where people like to go and will go there throughout the year. And, you know, and look after the land, et cetera, and, you know, just have a really nice place to camp.
Do it really well. Like, this doesn't have to be a punish, you know, like you got the biggest music festivals in the world that are one of them where they make their commercial piece and the other one where they do it for itinerant communities. And it's about joy and inspiration and ideas. And that's how you activate people who are stuck and feeling like they've got no hope. It's through that big story and energy and exchange.
We can leverage the big festivals mobs too, who have all that, you know, decade of experience of just being able to set up an entire really well-planned city, you know, in a couple of days for the duration of their festival. And, you know, they have some decent protocols in place for that. And you were mentioning the tiny homes too and portable homes. So there's that organization we're involved with, Big Tiny. And, you know, they're basically biodiversity network, kind of an Airbnb of tiny homes, where they will place for free, you know, tiny homes on the land. And people in their network will come and do biodiversity work and stay in those tiny homes. But then also you can rent the tiny homes out as income and engagement with the external economy to, you know, go into the pot to fund all the projects that you're running in that site. There's a whole heap of different things.
You also, I think then in terms of impact, that's the other thing that we've been looking at really deeply with we've been looking at this message stick that you carve twice, and then we for imagination are using that as a prototype to then look at placing it into a virtual production realm so we can see then context and people can sit around and make sense of the meaning of it. That might sound a bit esoteric, but what it gives us is it gives us a chance to look at the ones and zeros in another context. And I think, again, for this not to land in the ephemeral and to actually work for the systemic levers that we need, like Jim and Jim Chalmers at the Treasurer in Australia is working on a wellbeing index at the moment and looking at a different budget report coming out. The health of our land and in our each bioregion and each citizen's connection to that and how that potentially then goes right down to the taxes we pay or the taxes that are offset. And we pitched an idea about a decade ago to say, look, you know, we had at that point 5,000 university students volunteering. I said, why don't you just give a full fee paying university student in Australia, I think gets 20% off what they would for their course if they pay it back over time. So I said, why don't you just give the 20% cut that you will give to full fee paying students for the 5,000 students that volunteer and give their time. And it's a similar way that you could do that with custodianship. If you're mobilizing all these university students and just saying you get the full fee paying rebate for being a custodian in your community and going out and working on the land and being responsible for the bioregion, then again, that starts to make universities relevant as to why people would turn up on campus. And you have these huge dormant things, which are going to go, what are unis going to do in the next 20, 30, 40 years with all this space and property they've built? And the property value will go down because no one's living in it. And they're just going to try and work out what they do. And build another swimming pool. Like that's not, it's doesn't have an imagination that not only is like joyful, but is necessary for the design that we need in this period of time. And so I think the impact levers are there as well. Like, and the more that, you know, Tosh, you and I are finding ourselves in a lot of different spaces and places globally, like there's a desperation for movement, and there is just a lack of knowledge because most people are coming from an inherited set of systems, which the scorecards are busted. So if we can't look at impact and genuinely do that nationally, statewide, and then in our cities and then in our towns and then in our homes, then again, it won't move. But we can do that because there's people that are looking to move it. So yeah, I think our challenge is to turn up with some really practical pathways to go to a group that wants to give $15 million into carbon sequestration. Okay, here is a way this can move, and here are some things we want to try and prove from this in the next like 5 years, and here's how we can add health to a carbon market, which in principle, like, do offset it. Hopefully more of the offset is good, and over time more good than harm. Like that could be a good thing as we move down away from the practices that are not sustainable to a practice that is sustainable. So
well, just offset in general is unsustainable, you know, even as a word. So I mean, right from the start we were referring to them as extinction offsets to keep our eye on the ball so we didn't get too you know, caught up in it and away from the knowledge, you know, so we didn't end up just supporting ecocide globally, which is, you know, what a lot of the offsets market does. ProPublica is doing some pretty good research reporting and organizing around that. And what that does to indigenous peoples and landscapes in places like Guinea. They've got some pretty good research reporting and case studies around that. That message stick you mentioned, that law stick, you know, that was designed, and then the texts that have come out of that, the AI sort of generated animations and all the rest, as a way to bring people into the co-design methodology that we've built in the labs over the last 3 years, specifically around looking at the bio, you know, looking at ways of actually, you know, creating algorithms and things to be able to explain and design around the biocultural informatics, you know, of land and place and the way these connect up across, and you know how we can work with people like Guardians of the Earth, who have that massive hundreds of thousands of people network, doing almost like bird watching, but not just for birds, you know, for everything. And then, you know, there's this kind of peer review, almost blockchained process then that's available where, you know, it's verified. If one person sees it, you know, and then the next person verifies it as those three black cockatoos fly across the suburb, you know. So, you know, there's a whole, you know, amazing data, like crowdsourced data collection method there, but that can't be the only one. You got to triangulate it. So we're looking at the soundscape stuff. Johnny Meredithick has been looking at that crew, you know, where you can, in auditory terms, you know, measure the biodiversity of a place, having that data, and then that also then verified, you know, from at least, you know, one other method and one other source, you know, and the crowdsourcing one is free. So it has really good potential for setting up a verification system and then other systems of valuation, where we can look at these not being offsets anymore, but being like, you know, vibrant re-engagement with land onset, you know, late onset bloody custodial relations instead. Yeah. So this is all coming out of the labs, you know, all of this theory and methodology that's been, you know, a hard struggle over the last 3 years. Wouldn't happen without Paul Carney and, you know, the Carney group, who, you know, saw the potential from the start and have been, you know, they were the, you know, first out of the gate funders that were able to free us up to have the time to run this lab and to be able to focus on it. Yes, it's been pretty amazing. So, you know, so Paul's had that vision, you know, through the whole journey and has been backing us up the whole way and joining in for the big thinks and, you know, connecting up organizations and doing so much more. And PK, What do we got in the middle of all this? If that's the broad strokes, and we tried to bring in as many elements as we can, fast talking, you know, yeah, what's what? How do you see it being situated in there? And then kind of starting to zoom in on the idea of a proto, you know, a proto village.
Yeah, it's great hearing you guys talk about all the thinking that's been happening over the last few years, because even as someone who's close to it, like, it's just nice to hear the dots all connected up. To go to a, you know, tease out a couple of things that were, you know, said about the land is sick. The land is sick if you look at things through a particular perspective. I'm sure there's lots of people who would drive around thinking the land just looks like the land, but the people who know the land's sick. And if you get in amongst, you can feel that. People aren't happy either, just generally, like, whatever this is. And if you have a particular type of perspective and you understand that, you see that people are yearning for something else, that becomes self-evident. I was doing a course over, I am doing a course over the last few weeks with some people from Ethic in New York. And one of the key foundation thoughts that's come out of that early on is that all knowledge comes from perspective. And Tyson, it made me think of Sand Talk, like really early on in Sand Talk, about the, you know, learning the, your perspective view changes where you get. I think it's the old man Juma story. You know, you get down on the ground and you look at the terrain from ground level, etc., and you see
the ant view.
The ant view. That's right. And so all of that, so we've got this, you know, the basic premise of embedding people back in the land, of making the land healthy again, of making people healthy again. All of that stuff speaks really deeply to people who are listening. In order to actualize that, to get something happen, we've got this framework around the place where all the land is enclosed and people will live a particular way because it's the only way that they can live, etc., with all the incumbent problems around the place. And so that's kind of needs to be broken open somehow or other. And a way to do that is with big vision land project, that you can get your hands on the land and look at all of the principles, to absolutely centering all this brilliant work that's being done by IKSL, by AIM, and by indigenous thinking that's going on around the world, is the absolutely centering piece. And how can you get the land and then step through a project that designs quite deliberately the conditions to allow what we want to emerge over time? I've been thinking about this for a long time, and it's not as simple. We wish it was simple as kind of getting the land and dropping people in there or opening the gates or whatever. We've got a couple of things that we need to achieve. We've got to have the kind of capital that understands what's going on when most capital doesn't. So it's whether it's capital that's there for trying to do good, or it's capital that's there trying to get a return, or a bit of both. So we need that to introduce it, because to Jack's point, there needs to be scale, there needs to be proto, and then there needs to be scale. But then we've got all the layers of regulation to step through, because what you want to do has to be overlaid over what all the regulation is at the moment, and how do you navigate all of that so that you get to where you want to get. The regulation has to change, but we know that takes time. Like, you can't get that to change just because it's wrong. But then the other layer is you've got to get people who are conditioned to think of how they occupy space and live and have property or whatever. They've got to come to an understanding of a different way of doing it, which they will get to. But just because it's better for them doesn't mean that people get it in the first instance. And you've got to gradually find a way to help people move along the journey, like oil on timber or something, like a bit soaks in and a bit soaks in and a bit soaks in, so that you can get the design outcomes that you want. So you kind of got to move both fast and slow. That's what it feels like to me. Mm-hmm. Like we need a prototype the culture that's got to emerge in these spaces to get these things to work can't be forced too quickly.
It's a research project too, isn't it? Because that's how we will be able to test all these designs, and but you know, in a lot of different contexts as well, because it has to be adaptive. Yeah,
absolutely. With this particular project, so you know, I know that's kind of big picture, and then there's kind of looking for how this might happen, and then getting down into like this particular piece of land, which came across my view 6 or 8 months ago. It's connected to some people we work with and have known for a very long time, who we trust, and I could see when the project, you know, when you, what is it about an opportunity that you like, you just recognize there's enough in something that maybe this lines up with the potentialities that we're seeking. So it's a piece of land, substantial holding, about 1,000 acres, backs onto state forest, is surrounded by roads, so doesn't have the don't have to do your own thing. It's not, don't have sort of neighbor issues. It's been relatively gently, and I say that in inverted commas, farmed over the journey. It really interesting terrain. It's got some of the regulatory hurdles already covered in that, you know, land subdivision and, you know, things like that, which are important, which they weren't, but they are important, have been already dealt to. So there's a strong platform there potentially with some vision applied to it to use this as a project to bring this thinking in that the labs have been doing and apply it and get something moving and put it in the world and start to experiment with it. Question is, how do you fund? How do you get those first steps out of the gate to be able to get it moving with people who understand the journey that that this is on and are inspired by that? It's a long-winded argument, but this property has got those types, and you've been on the property and you've seen what it looks like and its current condition and some of the natural features and flora and fauna that's already there. So I know it gives me a sense that there's really something in this, but I've been really interested in what you felt when you were there.
Yeah, man, my head's still out in the economy, because there's that problem when you're engaging with the economic system like this, you know, of potentially it poses a risk to that system, etc. And especially real estate, because we're sort of shifting the idea of what land is. At the moment, like, it's a third of the world's capital is real estate. So, you know, what does this mean for the market? But I guess people need to ask themselves, what does it mean for the market that a lot of real estate is becoming uninsurable because of catastrophic risk from climate change, you know, as, you know, wildfires, bushfires, you know, superstorms, flooding is happening everywhere, you know. You know, so this is it's kind of like a disaster, not capitalism kind of thing that we're doing, because, you know, these provide relief, these sites, and the relationships that happen across all these communities. Then, you know, if they're already engaged in a fair bit of informal economy sort of trade, they're developing internal economies, then you end up with fairly resilient and adaptive infrastructure for supply chains for food and other goods and services that are needed for, you know, the next big pandemic or whatever, you know, the big risk is, the big catastrophe that disrupts the supply chains again, which we saw during COVID was a bit of a problem. So we have these kind of these things in place, and, you know, I guess we go in tandem, you know, in a kind of parasitic relation with the existing power structures and financial systems in the world now. So in the short term, with that parasitic relation, you know, have to benefit the host. you know, as change happens gradually, and you know, as you know, climate change kicks in more and more, and biodiversity loss over the next decade, and everything starts, the wheels fall off everything, then there's something there, you know. And so, you know, it's not about having a revolution to overthrow capital, you know, but as capital falls down in certain places, you know, we'll have this band-aid to patch it up. And, you know, and when the entire eventually, you know, real estate market does come down, there'll be alternative systems for value and housing there ready to step into the void. So there we are, and we're looking at this land, and you me went and walked over it, bros. You know, what, a month ago, or was it more like a month and a half? I don't know. It was a while back, but and we had that, spent that really nice day there with our families, and, you know, walking around and sort of just assessing with that Indigenous eye, about what the potential is for the systems there. It has really good groundwater. So you can see there are a lot of sort of, you know, pits and holes in the ground here and there from, you know, the gold fields, the gold rush days back in the old days, and holes where trees, you know, massive old growth trees have been cut down over the years and leaving those sort of pits. But those pits are filled to the brim right now this season with water, because the groundwater is so strong there and so solid. That's huge. The groundwater is pure, and you know, there's sort of no potential for that to be poisoned with where it is, and all any of the activity that's going on around the place is connected up to green corridors that, you know, we track to on the satellite images. You know, we track those, you know, because it goes through that state forest, and then, but then it continues, and we're even able to link up the systems flows between that and another project we're looking at with Kato Muir in the central desert. You know, so it's actually, you know, it with our songlines way of looking at things, and, you know, ancient protocols of traveling long distances for trade and ceremony together, you know, we're looking at all these systems flows. We're following those magpie geese and brolgas and all kinds of different migratory creatures that go across the continent, and even right across, you know, like, so, you know, down here where we are, there's those sandpipers that come all the way from Siberia. You know, we're working with cultural indicator species that travel the world, like humpback whales and all these sorts of things, and looking at how all these systems flows, these biodiversity systems flow and connect and migrate all around the world. And it has to be a holistic picture like that. If your biodiversity investment is not something that links up to the flows of other systems, then it will die. Because, you know, in a closed system, you're going to get entropy. That's the second law of thermodynamics. But we can see this here because it's connected up to so many healthy systems. You know, this place has been blasted by mining and sheep farming, you know, over the last century or so. It's and logging before that. You know, it's that resilient that we, you know, there are really solid little populations of some threatened species like the antechinus. You know, we saw those traces there. We've got, you know, we were there in the season when the black snakes were really active, you know, so we saw a few of those black snakes going after those antechinus. Big eagle's nest, big old one too, you know, that was really special. So as we came into the place, you know, we're following these signs, and we start with the ants because there's really good, strong meat ant population there, lots of those meat ants nests. And we watch those signs as they change throughout the day. You know, we knew the weather was going to change because it started out overcast, but then we saw the meat ants taking the black rocks, the darker rocks, down into the nest and replacing them with quartz, tiny quartz crystal rocks all over the nest. So we knew the sun was coming out. You know, so you can see all those really good bioinformatic signals going on, and all of the flora and fauna changing in response to that, like from the tiniest ant to all those signals going through the system, and that really good groundwater. And it looks like a place that seasonally has a lot of eel activity when they move through, because they're your big flows across land and over vast distances. you know, there'd be eels there that migrate out to Vanuatu and and all the way back, and then up rivers to breeding sites and you know, hatching sites, I mean birthing sites all along, you know, all through that system. We even found an old so we know that was a center for trade with eels, and that massive vibrant population of eels, because we found an old a tree from the old people that's for smoking eels. So it was a modified tree, you know, as a indigenous technology that was used to smoke, you know, the thousands of eels that they capture, and so that preserves it. And then that was an item of trade and wealth, you know, that went along these trading routes, you know, all over Australia. So that's really exciting when you look at that, the biocultural significance just of one place, and the potential for that to regenerate and re-energize, not just the biodiversity, but the flows that go out to other regions and language groups, and the embassy that occurs, you know, ritually and ceremonially here and there. The idea of bringing settlers into the, and you know, housing, situating, inducting gradually into a custodial relation with place. This is really powerful to me, you know, because you still have displacement going on around the globe with areas set aside for biodiversity sinks where indigenous populations are displaced because of that, or their communities and cultures are ruined, you know, by that interaction and the, you know, the way royalties are used to sort of blackmail people into, you know, situations that are against their best interests. You know, you see lots of sickness and death happening in these biodiversity offset places. But if we have, I don't want to use the word hostage, but no, if we have investment, you know, from, you know, dominant cultures and powerful people in these places, and if we have, you know, people of privilege in terms of non-indigeneity, et cetera, yeah, and I of course a diverse mix of people there, but if you have like people from the dominant culture and, you know, people of means who are invested there and living there, it's becomes trickier for people to come in and displace or remove those people, because, you know, so what a perfect way to do allyship, what a perfect way to for, you know, Australia's unearned capital, you know, to be invested together, you know, not just like redistributed, but you know, to be something that we all do together, and you know, redeploy to ensure that your children will still be alive in 30 years, which I think is pretty much a common goal of most of us. Yeah.
Yeah, you have.
I was just going to quickly say.
The,
hey!
Got him.
I'm going to be quiet.
The economics of this, I think, is like, again, to get into the practical of how someone can make money, I think we can answer that. I think there's also how you design it in a way that interconnectedness can come together with, whether it's song lines or desire lines and the cultural indicator species and the movement in between locations. I think we can answer that. And I think we can then answer, there's already existing, like in the first part, like of making money, there's a couple of subcategories that already exist. So I'll do the first bit. In terms of land, buying land that is worth not a lot of money, that no one's living on, that there is no behavior, no movement, no attention, no value, and nothing placed towards it. If you put people on there that bring attention to it, bring behavior, bring value, the land can then increase in value. So you can make your money back on the land, hypothetically, you know, is part one. Second one in Australia is where we've got it. I think we've got it wrong so far, but where there's a really beautiful opening is Uncle Bruce Pascoe and Uncle Noel Butler, is a couple of people we've been yarning to about a lot of this stuff. And Bruce wrote this book, Dark Emu, and done work with Black Duck with him and Noel. And they've been looking at plant breeders' rights and going, what would it look? So if you come up with if you breed a plant, a fusion, a mutation of two other plants together, you then call it the armchair plant, then you get IP rights back from that plant whenever it's sold anywhere. And their proposition is for all native plants, why don't the Indigenous people of that region where the plants are native to have plant breeders' rights and be able to have a revenue function? So if you were to reward the plant, if you created plant breeders' rights section B, which was native plants for Indigenous people, then inside that land, you then have an economic proposition on the plants that are being bred and the knowledge from those plants that can then be exported. And then there's a bunch of other trade areas if you're then, you know, like what they've been looking at with black duck, with flour or other things that you could create that could then feed a broader economy. So there's all of these pathways for very practical, pragmatic, existing column A trade. And the second part in terms of property investment is with people leaving cities, where are they going to go to? So you get in early on this unused land and you get in really early as we're starting to migrate and find safer land. It's just smart for the moneymakers as well. The middle space, which we haven't found yet around intelligence, is where I think it gets really interesting in the map. So if I was plotting part number two, which is how would you map this? I think we need 10 locations at once. I think we're in terms of running experiments, we're buying new land and going to it with different propositions and different people are buying new land, you know, land that's already been there. But that's one pathway. The other one is there's a bunch of IK operators that just want their land back, who know how to do this and know how to measure the value. And we can just help with the translation into modern tech, like the processes into Guardians of the Earth. Like Uncle Noel knows his land inside out. Like he knows it. And there's just challenges with getting land back, you know? And so that's really exciting. Just go, well, that design's already been well and truly done over thousands and thousands of years. And we just actually need some land back. That's a very practical investment, which, you know, you go $20 million over 10 lots of land globally. Okay, cool. We got the land back and we got the IK holders on the land who can then do this work. Then I think when you plug in the cultural indicator species that we've been looking at and their movement, then we can explore whether it's desire lines. We've been talking about Tice a lot or the song lines. But if we track that whale moving between those 10 lots of land around the world, and we track that eagle moving between those 10 lots of land around the world, then we can start to understand the value of non-human species in our intelligence and our value and our well-being. And we can see that the whale's carrying story for us and carrying energy for us between the places. And that's what's lifting the health of that interconnectedness. And I think in the 10 entities, it can't just be like lots of land. It's got to be a city as well. So you run a parallel of a variety of different like microcosms and you run this parallel experiment, but you show that the house, anyone's average house, like is connected to that lot of land in Victoria, connected to the lot of land in Central Desert, connected to a lot of land in Mali where they're still singing, like, and that's all connected to the whales and the ants and those different areas. So I think the plant breeders' rights gives us one economic playground that already exists around plant IP. But then there's things around the custodianship of like the eel or the ant or the whale and what value they bring to us economically. And we've looked at like carbon sequestration as one example with whales at the moment. Some people are looking at that, but there's so much more if we start to see the intelligence and the IP relationship with the other species. Mm. And I actually think we have that now. Like we have that experiment ready. We have the IK people all around the world, like planet Earth, I mean, by we, we're here. So part of it is actually restoring land and then listening to the processes that already exist, like the way Taishi walked around and did the photo essay, listening to the processes, then adapting it into frames that we can translate it into impact, and then showing the movement of value that is monetized right now, but then value that is towards health and well-being and our collective intelligence. And I do think that is like, we can get that into a deck now, you know, in terms of translation, we can do that.
That's it. And look, there's a lot of solutions proposed and a lot of really good people doing a lot of good work around the place. So, I mean, you know, in terms of your biodiversity offsets, carbon credit schemes, all that sort of thing, you know, this is looking at monetizing and financializing nature and these entities that we know, like eel, whale, ant, you know, it's looking at financializing and monetizing that. And that's, you know, ethically, and in every way, like, you know, as a human being, you must rebel against the very idea. It just seems disgusting. But mostly the alternatives that are offered are about legalizing these things, like bringing them into legal frameworks so that you're giving the eel human rights or giving a river human rights kind of thing. But that's wrong too. Our old people say, no, he's not a human being. You know what I mean? That's not how that works. You know, so harnessing these entities to a legal framework within a, you know, a colonial or imperial system, that's not really the answer either. So, you know, what we're looking for is transitional, transitory engagement with these systems that will be mutually beneficial as we go along, until the system, as all systems do, mutates, changes, adapts into something else, as it inevitably must move with the land, and the land is changing.
You reckon, Tice, with the with the
shaking us off, like fleas off a dog.
Do you reckon they in terms of the monetization? So, column A, you know, the value of the whale is worth $1 billion. Like, if that doesn't check out, column B, you know, this doesn't check out in terms of the human rights. That movement of the desire lines, and what we've got with, like, you know, protecting species and marketplaces for endangered species, feels like that, you know, in all three of those realms, there is a desire and a move to moving wealth. The early proposition and challenge is a third of the market is all real estate. So if we don't shift from buildings to plants, if we don't shift from buildings to species, then does it just stay in real estate and we keep building these, like, buildings which have no relation? So what is there a space in the variety of vocabulary that we can find that looks at the shape and the, like, the elements around these species, you know? So that's where I think intelligence, like, when I think about our, that relationship with intelligence with species, that feels like, you know, what do we go to MIT Media Labs for? What do we go to universities for? What do we go to school for? And what's our intelligence, like, worth? And that nature was first and we came after. And so we should be looking at our movement back to, for that circularity.
That's it.
But well, I suppose it's the health of the frame and the wealth of.
It's in the sustainability and ongoing viability of these projects once they're set up, because, you know, so you're looking at within the current carbon credits, biodiversity offset sort of system, you're looking at your initial outlay for the land, your initial investment being paid off within 5 or 10 years, you know, but then, you know, you have then basically a group of unpaid workers, you know, who are, you know, the benefit that they're receiving is having a place to live and, you know, doing the work of re-engaging with the land. You know, I don't know, there hasn't been I don't think there's been a sounder investment since slavery for this one, because it's actually just, you know, people, but voluntary, you know, coming in and working on the land in ways that create internal economies and that still interact with external economies as well. I think that, all of the answer, and I think, you know, PK can jump in and sort of verify and expand on this, but it lies in the viability and the sustainability of the investment long after you've received back all the returns you needed on that investment. You know, you can walk away happy knowing in your portfolio there's something there that's a gift that keeps on giving, something there that, you know, will just magnify and continue well into the future. But what's interesting is that it's non-competitive, because, you know, you can't smash one of those, you know, in order to, you know, destroy your competitor or do a hostile takeover or something like that, because of the interconnected nature of these systems. You know, it's in your best interest to look after the next guy's portfolio. So right there, we're changing what finance is, you know, one small step at a time. We're planting that seed of a sort of a mutually supportive global economy, a bit of Yehudi economics, relational economy. We're planting the seeds of that so that, you know, in future when these things must change and are no longer viable, that we have something tried and true that's in place, and we have all the communications infrastructure and the transport infrastructure and everything else all in place. PK.
There's just a few things that have come up for me in this yarn. The this idea of perspective shift. So what I can potentially see is you know, we talk about real estate, like if there's a perspective shift from the place one occupies as being a piece of real estate to an idea of place, if there's a change around perspective on what economy is and what participation in economy is, if there's a change in understanding of currency and the way currency works, like you know, we are stapled into a system that requires that all currency is originated from private banks, and there are other ways of generating currency in local economy that free up that. All of these and the other perspective shift is what is home? How do I live? Like when I'm living somewhere, how does that look? How many people around me? How is that? There's all these perspective shifts that will change, which will eventually undermine the kind of economic settings we've got around the place, but in a way that allows the land to be rehabilitated, people to be rehabilitated, etc. It's just a powerful concoction of things. My witness is that people's perspective needs to shift, and this is these models are a way to get that perspective to move, which is fundamental for the transition that's going to be required ahead. I don't know if that sounds a bit woo, but this is a practical place to facilitate those shifts. Just because it has to happen, though, doesn't mean that people can see it immediately. And Jack, you talk about virtual descriptions of this and using, you know, film and art and so on to describe this. This is how you activate people's understanding that this shift is possible. Ties back in the early days, we used to talk about basins of attraction. Like, what are these? How do you create these basins of attraction that becomes strong enough that people will move themselves out of their current paradigm into the new paradigm? And we know that the indigenous, as a settler, I know that the indigenous perspective of this holds the key.
And they're just like labs, you know, like if you think about real estate, like we want 1,000 labs on land. And if it's a lab, you then, as a settler, you visit the lab, you get smarter. Like that's the exchange. Right. You go to a lab, you get smarter. And so if we can activate 1,000 Indigenous Knowledge Systems labs, then we can run a parallel set of experiments at the same time of one lot of land in Victoria, one lot of land in Guatemala, one lot of land in Don Turtle Island. You can activate a parallel set, and then you can run the data set at the speed that we need. And we can focus on, as much as possible, the interrelation of those species moving in between. Like, the stack's there. You know, we've got the IK work, we've got processes, we've got people who have done this forever. But I think it's the boxing of real estate, like, to then going, well, what's this lot of land? This land is a lab. Like, this is a lab we need for the next century and beyond. Like, this is the lab, you know? So if a prime minister wants to come and sit down in a lab, they come and sit in a lab, you know, in Victoria or in Central Desert, but it's the place of this laboratory. And that then gives us the freedom to do what big thinkers have always done, which is why I've always loved the title that you stumbled across with it, Tice. Like, it's just, I've never seen the translation land in a way that moves us from this block where we were stuck in the past with our thinking, and then there was just modernity. But to have Indigenous Knowledge Systems labs at the start of the design queue, then that's the economy. And in terms of value, like, we're already with Imagination, we've got 13 systems change like leaders that we've picked in our systems change studio who are like moonshot ballers. Like, they're unbelievable. Yep. We're flying them to Wollongong, you know, in Australia. Like, they're coming here. That is tourism. That's putting Australia on the map. Like, we're bringing now money, people with money and wealth to Australia. Like, we're bringing this Chinese group that we're talking to, or other people we're talking to, like, they're looking at investing here, and that's value for Australia. So I think that in terms of the moving tourism to, you know, from going and being like, and here is a plant, to then going, well, here is the process of how this plant lives and breathes, and here is the process of how you can apply this in your organization to have more joy in your organization or improve the health of your city. then I think we start to get scale as well, because if you've got those 1,000 labs as an example, you can then set the challenge for, you know, millions of kids to do a similar thing. And then you can say to people, all right, come and visit this lab, and the same money that you would pay your $50,000 to go to Stanford for a fast course on how to be an executive might be better suited over here. So spend your 50 grand, 300 of you, and come out here for 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And then you've got a full economy that's running there, and you've got proper employment for people. And it doesn't, you know, the efficiency of some of these other universities and thinking institutions that we've seen, we can apply that to the land as well. So you can run a multi-stack to the business function of it, so you can still have money moving to support each other and have some abundance.
Yeah. Well, I mean, how often do investors get to, you know, just buy stocks in a company and then go hang out on the factory floor, or, you know what I mean? And or get in there and, you know, enjoy the excitement of what's happening in the engineering lab or something. They don't. It's all at a distance. This way they get to connect. They get to scratch that itch and soothe that deep longing for a connection. Like real connection with other people and with land and with nature, what they call, you know, a return, you know,
that is
empty space, that empty space in all these people, you know, this is healing. You know, we're addressing so many issues with this project. You know, it solves a lot of things around homelessness, climate change, you know, and displacement and disruption happening with climate change. You know, the even the insurance problem, the fact that, you know, all these places are uninsurable now, you know, natural disasters, biodiversity loss, and everything that goes on with that. You know, so much of the catastrophic risk stuff is tied up with this. And the way PK, you remember, like right back at the start, the way we envisioned this was, you know, and we were talking about homelessness, you know, being an escalating problem with more and more people unhoused, and not just poor people, not just people with mental illness. Now it's a big thing. You got middle class people who are having to park a tent, you know, down the road because, you know, it's just smashing everybody. And that's no good for the economy. It's no good for increasing the velocity of the dollar or anything else that you need. Yeah, it's just creating disasters. So right from the start, we were looking at that idea of homelessness as an increasing problem. And we said, it's not, homelessness isn't the problem. It's landlessness,
yes.
You know, and from top to bottom in this society, no matter how much real estate you own on paper, you're still landless. You know, everybody in this world is dirt poor, you know, unless you're indigenous people who are lucky enough to be living on your land. And lucky enough for it, not just to be native title, where you have to go and live in a town, all packed in together, because that's the only way that you can, because you, you know, lose your kids if you don't send them to the school there. And, you know, you have to be checking in every week, and you have to be employed, or you have to be signing on, going into the office at Centrelink 3 times a week, or they'll cut off your pay, and your access to medical benefits is dodgy, and all these sorts of things. So, yeah, this is a solve for all of that. Because, I mean, it's hard. Everybody says, you know, oh, like 80% of the biodiversity on the planet is cared for by Indigenous people. And it's like, well, you know, we've got massive land masses with native title here. But in this system, that doesn't mean anything. That does not give people empowerment and capacity to be able to care for that country in any kind of sustainable way, in any kind of way that doesn't ruin your life and have your kids taken away from you. So, you know, this resolves that, because you don't need native title in this system in order to save the land. You need freehold title right now. And that's, you know, hopefully that won't be the way forever, but you need freehold title. And so, you know, this is a really neat little mechanism that Johnny Mayer at Ethics sort of proposed right from the start, is that, you know, the people invest in the real estate, they get their return, you know, plus all the interest and everything else that they could expect from a return on investment in real estate. They get that back over 5 years to a decade of biodiversity offsets, revenues, and carbon credits. And I think you calculated, you know, based on current figures, a pretty good estimate of this block that we're looking at. You know, you know, that it would be like 5 to 7 years or something before, you know, the initial investment would be covered.
And you have, sorry, PK.
There's a couple of transitions in place. There's the how does the initial investment or however this gets seeded, the way those people are compensated. I think there's two things. There's financial compensation in part, but I think there also is going to be, to the point you made earlier, people who are looking for a different story from their investment who want, I think, Jack, you might recall our very first conversation. I remember we discussed finance over in New York. We discussed the fact that most finance is inert. It's like completely removed from people. And I know, but Johnny's working on over in ethics. How do people come to understand the story behind what their investments are doing? Because people will be activated by that. So we'll have both of those kinds of interests. Simultaneously to that, while that's happening, the people who are in place on the land, will be developing their own separate economy in that land. So it's not like there's only one that belongs to the investor. There's another one that the other people, and there's a kind of a slide between one and the other I can see happening over time. So it's potentially the homelessness thing that you, the landlessness, which I love the phrase that, or placelessness. I think as a settler who's got, you know, no idea where my family, I came from Ireland, but I don't know where they came from. Like, placelessness I feel acutely, and I think many other people feel acutely as well. But yeah, I don't want to rise the sort of overstate the importance of that. The most important thing is embedding people back in land, getting Indigenous people land back, and getting them back in place. I know there's a bit of a ramble, I suppose, but the financial side of things, there's how the people who activate it, how it works for them, but then there's the economy that emerges if this is done well.
Yeah. And you have in on the school kid solution as well, like you've got homeschooling models. There is no stronger home than being back on the land and being able to, if you're an education minister federally or in state or setting government policies on what education is going to look like for the future, if you're not looking at 40% of jobs already being munched up by automation and the future of our economics being custodial economies as a big section pathway that's necessary to feed the biodiversity that we need, to feed nature funds, to feed our behavior with all these offsets, then you can as well in these first like 10 communities say, all right, there's an option that if you achieve the accreditation of your custodianship, your development, looking after the land, you're intelligent, you can be back on that land, that can be accredited as an educational experience. And that can be as strong and as valued as any secondary education globally. And if we can do that in parallel, then you're building the talent pool, because we don't have a talent pool at the moment. And so that piece then means that, you know, Indigenous families can have their kids on country and being actually experts in what we've already had for a long period of time, which got disrupted for 200 years. So that requires some courage to say, actually, we don't know how to educate everybody and there is knowledge here. So part of the home piece and part of this being a proper lab is being able to have the capacity when NASA's building its rocket ship next to, you know, Aboriginal communities in the central desert as well, that NASA can actually come and learn from custodianship, not the other way around. Playing the two parallels is critical, and it's necessary for that intelligence to be able to move. So I think that's what hopefully we can help out with some of the seeding stuff with custodial presidents through imagination and some micro support to say, here is a homeschooling model, you know, and we value this, because if we end up not working and 40% of us like don't have jobs, we better be able to look after the land.
Homeschooling is a really good metaphor, actually, because the problem with homeschooling is exactly the same as what has been the problem with biodiversity offsets. It's the kind of isolationist mentality of it. You know, you get this piece of land that is, you know, cut off from everything else, and that is a, you know, a haven, a refuge, an island of unmoving ecology. you know, that rests there, and ultimately it collapses in on itself. Homeschooling is the same problem in that in a lot of cases it's people who are isolating themselves, you know, because of their attitude towards the world or an ideology they have or something else, or fears for their children, you know, often, you know, pretty well justified fears, but nonetheless it is isolating those children. But if you build on that and complexify what homeschooling is, it goes up to what many people are doing in communities around Australia, which is more like village schooling. You know, so, you know, people are, yeah, like on paper they're homeschooling, but really they're village schooling. And that means they have access to, you know, many community mentors, and that they can achieve all of the, you know, all of the knowledge to be able to be accredited, you know, and pass their exams, you know, in the regular system as well. But they're also learning heaps of land-based knowledge and hands-on knowledge and practical knowledge and how to fix an engine rather than having to chuck it on the scrap heap kind of thing. So it's pretty, I don't know. Yeah, it's pretty exciting stuff when you see places where there are networked homeschoolers, you know, doing village pedagogy together. That's the kind of thing. But even that's not enough. Those need to be networked out with other villages and other networks so that you can have curriculum exchange, so that you can then have partnerships with mainstream schools as well, so that your students can go in and access the stuff they need to do there, can access exams as needed, access university entrance, etc. And so then you end up with scrutiny that's networked. And that's why the peer review part of this is going to be really important. What we call embassy, Wanju, what we're calling, so that ritual embassy and those protocols of engagement, those indigenous ancient protocols of multi-tribal gathering and exchange and trade, this is the protocols that are needed, because you end up with peer review processes that are going on all the time, so that you don't end up with little enclaves of evil people doing shitty things to kids, which often happens in intentional communities and even in insular homeschooling groups as well. You know, so that's the thing. It's got to scale as our governance scales in our Aboriginal governance systems on this mainland that have been there forever, you know, from the self in relation to your kinship pairs, to your family, to your clan, you know, and there's at each scale of governance, there's different built-in layers of accountability and absolute transparency right through the system as you scale out to, you know, tribal groups, regional groups, collections of tribal groups that get together for ceremony. And then beyond that, scaling to the continental level and beyond, into our like traditions of trade up into Asia and Melanesia as well. Pretty damn exciting. You know, this is the indigenous systems knowledge, you know, that we're building things on. It's not just little cultural snippets and bits of like, wow, that's amazing. No, it's our capacity for entire integrative systems of ecologies, governance, education, everything, you know. So it's a bit of an everything project, this one. Haven't got a name for it really. We've just been referring it to it as the landlessness project, because there isn't a word that sort of encompasses, you know, everything. You can't name it after the problem. You're cursing it from the start, eh?
HOME. Back at home.
I thought you were spelling it out because that stood for something like holistic.
No, yeah, holistic ontology. Yeah, that's about my brain.
Maximizing effort. One of the rings being your totem there, bros, the platypus. Latin name. Romans. The Romans are still colonizing us with their language. What an amazing system that was. Final words, PK.
I see a hell of a lot in this. Jack, I hear completely that the, you know, we don't have time like this. We've got to, whatever we do, we need to scale the land and city, and all of these domains are really important. I'm trying to figure out in my head, because of the world I come from, what the steps that they, in order to make this, bring this into life, the steps that have to be pushed through from the perspective of how you activate this, which is finance and capital and whatnot, and how you deal with the regulatory cage that we're in that needs to be broken down, but it's not going to be broken down as we want to. So, and bring people along the journey who won't see it all immediately until it becomes more, until discussion gets out there about it. They just won't get it. But you've got to start somewhere, and a real project is a way to do it. So, maybe this is a real chance. Well,
solves that struggle in everyone's heart of how do you reconcile the desire for, power and autonomy, but also relatedness. And, that's the basic governance structure here, and education structure and everything else is, giving everybody the capacity and the opportunity to have, a kind of autonomous interdependence, which was the early promise of the internet, in every zone, in business, in education, everything else. That was the early promise, that it was going to deliver this capacity for everybody to be individually autonomous, but also, interdependent and, therefore dependent on collectives and on looking after each other. That's what the European Economic Union was supposed to do, and all of that, global regionalism movement that started in the 90s. We've all been striving towards this. Everybody knows what needs to happen. UN knows what needs to happen, but we just don't have these basic governance structures and systems in our everyday sovereign lives. And that's what everybody desires, like from the poorest person to the richest person. So let's get it done. Let's get it done, my brothers, my siblings. Make it happen, JMP, huh?
Yep.
We can close it up. We're going over. We're eating into labs time now. We got to get back to the work. Yeah, world's not going to fix itself. Mm. Hey, thanks, BK.
All right, lovely to talk, guys.
No worries. Catch you later.
Okay. Oh.